Welcome, everyone, to our expert series, where I will have thoughtful conversations with subject matter experts focused on the complex needs of ultra-affluent families. For those of you who do not know me, I'm Austin Delvey, private wealth advisor with Wise River Advisors, a distinguished team within UBS Private Wealth Management. On today's episode, I have with me Rob Strauss, an estate planning attorney and partner with Weinstock Mannion. Today, we will be discussing the importance of estate planning and planning before the election with the looming 2025 sunset of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. In order to make compliance happy, I have to tell you that I'm located in Los Angeles, California. I can be reached at austin.delvey@ubs.com, and Rob Strauss is not affiliated with UBS Financial Services, Inc.
Thank you for having me. So I'm Rob Strauss. I'm a partner at this firm called Weinstock Mannion, which is an estate planning firm. All we do at our firm is estate planning. We have, I think, 23 lawyers, and we've subdivided this relatively narrow niche of estate planning still further. So we have a team that only does trust and estates litigation, and thankfully I'm not on that team. And we have a team that does primarily post-death work, such as estate tax returns, probate when necessary, although we do everything possible to avoid it, and generally administering estates. And we have a team that does while you're alive planning, and I'm on that. And in my practice, I spend approximately 75% of my time designing appropriately creative and sophisticated structures to help wealthy individuals and families accomplish what they're trying to accomplish. Usually, that would be getting assets to their families, getting assets to their favorite charities, and not paying estate tax. It's not always the case. Sometimes there are other goals and objectives that have to be integrated into a well-designed plan. And then in addition to that, I spend about 25% of my time designing basic plans for people who just need to have basic plans, but done properly. In my practice, I actually have a national reputation for designing structures to help clients pay less estate tax when that's appropriate. That's what we do.
Okay, good enough. So you cover all the bases. I know you focus a lot on the advanced planning side of things for, you know, complicated situations. And I think for a lot of our listeners and people out there that will be listening to this, I think providing a little context around why estate planning is important is a good segue into things, because the landscape's always changing, but I think there's always the basics of why we need an estate plan. So if you could share a little bit more about why we need an estate plan and why this is important for families.
Sure, of course. At the very most basic, families need an estate to define who inherits their assets at their death, even if the assets are supposed to go in equal shares to the kids. And especially in California, it's necessary to have an estate plan because of probate. In California, without a revocable living trust, we have to go through probate. And there are three reasons that we don't want to have to go through probate, which, by the way, is a court-supervised estate plan. The first reason is it's public. Most families don't want anything to do with their assets or their family to be aired in public. They want to keep it private. The second reason is it's time-consuming. Going through probate could take as little as 6 months, but it could take as long as 6 years. It's a function of how complicated are the assets, how challenging they are to value, whether there's anybody who's going to challenge what's been done and disagree with the government's plan for what your assets should be. And then the third reason, which may be the most important reason, is that it's expensive. It's very expensive. To give you a sense for that, the probate fee in California for just $1 million of assets is $22,400. That's a statutory fee that's based upon the gross value of the estate. And that statutory fee gets paid to two different parties. So multiply that number by two. It gets paid to the lawyer who handles the probate. So we would get rich on probate, except we have a fiduciary duty to our clients to help them avoid probate. And it also gets paid to the executor. The executor is the person in charge of the probate from a client perspective. And those fees aren't negotiable. They're statutory. Now, it's a declining percentage from there. But once upon a time, I had a client die before we were able to put their revocable trust in place with some $50 or $60 million worth of assets. And it resulted in a probate fee of almost $400,000. What a colossal waste of money. It's easy to avoid. And the way you avoid it is by establishing a revocable living trust and transferring ownership of your assets to the trust. Believe it or not, when the individual human beings die, because the revocable trust owns the assets, we've created the fiction that the owner of the assets, which is now the revocable trust, did not die. And that avoids a probate. I know that it sounds bizarre, but that's exactly how the law works in California. So the normal components of a basic estate plan would then consist of a revocable living trust, which becomes the centerpiece of the estate plan, where husband and wife together are the trustees, and husband and wife together are the beneficiaries. And then typically at the first death, the surviving spouse is the sole beneficiary of what results from the revocable trust. And then typically at the second death, the kids in equal shares are the beneficiaries after the surviving spouse's death. Now, there are all kinds of variations of that. There are all kinds of details. And of course, you have to talk through those details very appropriately and carefully with the client to ensure that they understand what's going on and they can make good and informed decisions. When you have the revocable trust as the centerpiece of the estate plan, the wills become very simple documents. The wills basically say, hey, if I forgot to put my assets in the trust, the executor of my will is instructed to do so. The wills might do one more thing. If the clients have minor children, the wills would identify who should be the guardian of their minor children. But that's it. Wills become very simple documents. It's not at all like you see in the movies or on TV, where there's a formal reading of the will and the will defines who inherits the assets. It's not done in the will in California. It's done in the revocable trust. The remaining components of a basic estate plan would consist of financial powers of attorney, where the spouses would name each other to make financial decisions. They themselves become incapacitated, can't make those decisions for themselves, as well as healthcare documents, where the spouses would name each other to make healthcare decisions for themselves if they're unable to make those decisions for themselves. And then, of course, we want to fund the trust. The trust, once funded, can be unfunded at any time. Specifically, you can transfer assets into the revocable trust and take assets out of the revocable living trust at any time, from time to time, and without any restrictions at all. The revocable trust does not get a taxpayer identification number or a social security number. It uses the social security number of the individual human beings who are creating the trust. The revocable trust does not file an income tax return. Everything continues to be reported on the individual's personal 1040s in exactly the same way that it was before the formation and funding of the revocable trust. And so what we see is, after forming and funding the revocable trust, it really is completely looked through, see through. It's ignored for all purposes but one, the one purpose for which it's not ignored. It takes title to the client's assets. So if the client owns a home, we're creating a deed conveying title into the trust. If the client has a brokerage account at UBS or elsewhere, we're asking the account advisor to do the paperwork to change the owner to reflect the fact that it's the revocable trust that's now the owner. We fund the trust. And that's the basic estate.
I think that's a great overview. And one of the points that you made, which I think is an important aspect of setting up a trust and estate planning, is you mentioning of the information being public. I think that's a huge one and something that a lot of families, I don't necessarily know that aspect of it. You know, there's the, you know, we should have an estate plan, we should create a trust and thing. But I think that's one of the most important aspects of estate planning and what you just reviewed is that information's public. And a lot of families like to keep their financial assets and things that they own not public.
Certainly so. I don't have a single client who would want their information disclosed publicly. And of course, we have famous people who go out of their way to prevent public disclosure.
Absolutely. And we could probably have a full day conversation on that topic and what families do to protect their name and background.
We could.
So, but indeed. So with that and all of the basic planning, how often are families typically revisiting their estate plans and updating documents? You know, you mentioned titling of their assets, which there are families that have trusts, but they don't necessarily remember to title their assets in the name of the trust, and you know, complicates things. So not only is it potentially helpful to update their trust documents or their documents, but it also gives them an effort to remember to put assets in their name. So how often is it typical?
That's a great question. And the importance of that question is underlooked and underappreciated, especially because we get clients all the time who did a revocable trust, for example, 20 years ago, and think that they are done. But the world has changed so much that it is now the case that the document that they created doesn't deal with their situation at all. So there are three reasons, I think, that clients should take a look at what they've done. The first reason is if the tax law changes. Now, I'm here to tell you that the tax law has in fact changed a lot over the last 20 years in small ways. I don't think the tax law has changed in a big way other than for the fact that the estate tax exemption has climbed so high. And that itself creates opportunity and itself is a reason to revisit a revocable living trust that may have been done in the past because there are new structures and strategies that we can incorporate into a revocable living trust to take advantage of the fact that the exemption is so high right now. So changes in the law. Ordinarily, what we would do for changes in the law is we would send out a notice to all of our clients alerting them to the change and inviting them to reach out to us and have a conversation about whether those changes impact their documents. The second reason that a client should consider revisiting their estate plan is if their net worth changes in a material way, either positively or negatively. What usually happens is the net worth changes positively. And as a consequence of that change, the structure built into the prior revocable trust could be improved dramatically. Here's an example. Suppose a client did a revocable trust when they were worth a couple million dollars and they had kids. But because the net worth was relatively low, I say relative because we're in California, we're in Los Angeles, where people have 20 million, 200 million, 2 billion. So 2 million is at the lower end. Even though someone who's managed to accumulate 2 million from scratch has done a pretty impressive job. And I don't mean to cast aspersions. I'm just describing the type of structure that would be appropriate for that level of wealth. They might say that when husband and wife are gone, the kids can inherit those assets outright and free of trust because it's a relatively small amount. But if the $2 million of assets grew to $200 million, it might no longer be appropriate for the children to inherit outright and free of trust. It might be wise for the children to inherit inside of ongoing lifetime irrevocable trusts because if they did, they could receive three benefits that they would not otherwise get with an outright distribution. Those three benefits would be some degree of divorce protection, some degree of liability and creditor protection, and some degree of estate tax protection through the use of generation skipping. So that's an example of how a change in net worth should result in at least a rethinking of the basic trust structure for the benefit of the family. And then the third reason that clients should revisit their structure is if the people that they've named to play key roles in their documents, for example, to be the successor trustee, for example, to be the person making healthcare decisions, for example, the person to be the guardian of minor children, if those people have changed. We all have relationships with friends and with family that change and evolve over time. Hopefully they're strengthening, but sometimes they don't. Sometimes you fall out of bed. And it's appropriate to remove those people either because they're no longer appropriate, because the relationship is strained, or because they're too old, or because they're infirm, or they don't want to do it, or they're dead. All kinds of reasons. So those three reasons, a change in the law, a change in net worth, a change in people. And I think that it would be wise for clients to look at their documents, even for 5 minutes, every couple of years. And if you look at it for 5 minutes, you say, yeah, this sort of still makes sense. Good for you. If you look at it for 5 minutes to say, I wonder if we should make a change, that client should reach out to his or her estate planning attorney and schedule a conversation. Now, it might be a short conversation. Doesn't mean that you're signing up to pay millions of dollars in fees. It just means you're seeking information. The information might not result in a change. It might result in a change.
And it's always just something to revisit that. Even personally, reading through your documents or a summary is just a refresher, because just touching on, I think one of the more important things that you said is your life changes over time, your friends mm-hmm. and relationships change. You know, you may not be friends or close with the same people that you were in middle school when you're an older adult and have an established family and business. And if at one point you trusted those individuals making healthcare decisions for you, and your relationship has changed, that might also warrant wanting to revisit who you now, later in life, are trusting with financial or health decisions for your estate.
I think that's right. And Austin, what you said about ensuring that the trust is actually funded is critical. That any time the client thinks about his or her estate plan, they should think about the assets that they own and whether those assets have been properly titled in the name of the trust.
Right. Right. So I think that's a good segue into assuming the families have their basic estate plan. They are an ultra high net worth family. They've got everything in place and they're looking to do some of the more advanced planning where they want to lower their estate tax. They want to start gifting to either the next generation or the generation below. I think before we get into the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act and some of the pre-planning there, I think it would be good to talk about what are just some basic ways families and why families who have a large net worth or a large estate dollar-wise, why they gift to their children or their grandchildren earlier on and what those numbers look like.
Sure. So I think the place to start is to understand that each individual client can give away during lifetime or die owning to the extent not given away during lifetime, what's called the estate tax exemption amount, the exemption amount. It's referred to in verbal format because it's a number that changes every year. And this year, the estate tax exemption is at an all-time high. It's $13.61 million for each of husband and wife. So it's $27.2 million on a combined basis. And what that means, husband and wife can give away $27.2 million worth of assets and not pay any gift tax. Or if they didn't do that while they were alive, they can die owning $27.2 million worth of assets and not pay any estate tax. It's a very, very high number. If they happen to die owning more than that, the excess is taxed at 40%. So to give a really simple example, if the exemption is 27.2, and they die owning $37.2 million of assets, the first $27.2 passes free of estate tax. The excess is $10 million in a 40% estate tax bracket. That results in $4 million of estate tax. The exemption amount is changing in two ways. First, it's increasing with inflation. So as we transition from the year 2024 to the year 2025 in 5 months or so, our expectation is that the exemption will increase by some amount related to inflation. We don't know yet how much that amount is, but I'm going to guess that it's going to be something like $14 million or $14.1 million. So then on a combined basis between the husband and wife, the exemption becomes $28 million or $20.2 million, some number like that. That's the first change. The second change, already built into the law, is an automatic reduction by 50% of that exemption amount, taking place in just 17 months. On 1/1/26, absent action by Congress, the exemption will fall in half. So really, what we're confronting is a political question. Will Congress take action? I think that predicate question is, what happens in the election this coming November? Here's my take. I can't predict the election. I cannot forecast the election. I'm not going to try to do that, especially because the professional pollsters do such a poor job of predicting the election. But let's talk about results. It's my sense that if Democrats win any one, the presidency or a majority in the House of Representatives or a majority in the Senate, it's likely, but not certain, that the exemption would actually fall. And in contrast, it's my sense that if Republicans win all three, the presidency, a majority in the House, a majority in the Senate, that it's likely, but not certain, that the exemption would not fall. Now, I say likely, I'm not certain in each scenario because a compromise could happen. And we've already experienced a compromise that surprised everyone in the estate planning community. Going back in 2012, as a refresher, in 2012, the exemption was $5 million scheduled to fall to $1 million. And that was the year that Obama was campaigning on a $3.5 million exemption. So most of the estate planning community assumed that the exemption would fall from $5 million down to $3.5 million. But all the while, unless and until some law was passed, it was actually going to fall from $5 million to $1 million. As a consequence, we were extremely busy helping clients to navigate what it might mean for their estates if the exemption actually did fall. All that year, all of 2012, in the middle of December of 2012, Congress passed a law extending the exemption at $5 million. It did not fall to $1 million. It did not become $3.5. It was extended to $5 million, and nobody saw it coming. How did that happen? Well, it happened by compromise. Obama wanted something else, and in order to induce Republicans to give him the something else that he wanted, he gave Republicans an extended $5 million exemption. So I don't know for sure that the exemption will fall if Democrats win one of those three positions. I don't know for sure that the exemption won't fall if Republicans win all three, but those are the trend. And so what we're finding now is that our clients fall into three categories, and they all have to be dealt with separately. The first category are clients who would not have a taxable estate no matter what happens to the exemption. Clients who are worth $14 million or less, they don't have to worry about it. And in fact, they should not worry about it because they would be better off continuing to own all of their assets and enjoying the benefit of all of their assets so that when they die, there's a step up in basis to full fair market value and there's no estate tax. They just need to have a proper basic estate plan. The second category of clients are clients who are worth more than the estate tax exemption amount today. Those clients have taxable estates. They need to think through what to do about it, no matter what happens with the exemption, unless the exemption increases from here. So if you had a client, for example, worth $35 million, that obviously exceeds a $27 or $28 million exemption. They've got to think through what to do. Now, it's okay with me if they decide not to do something, as long as that's an affirmative decision based on actual knowledge. I don't want it to be an accidental decision because they neglected to consider it. What they should do is another question. I'll come back to that in a minute. The third category is the most challenging category. It's the clients who today don't have a taxable estate, but who would have a taxable estate if the exemption falls. And here's why it's challenging. Let's suppose you have a client who's worth $25 million at a time when the exemption is $27. They don't need to do anything today. And if the exemption does not fall, they don't need to do anything. And in fact, they would be better off not doing something because if they don't do something, meaning making gifts, if they don't do something, it will get a step up in basis to fair market value at death, and the kids will inherit advantaged assets that they could sell without paying capital gains tax. But if the exemption falls, they would need to have already done to capture the exemption. But if they already have done something to capture the exemption before it falls, and the exemption doesn't, they're actually worse off. So it's a very challenging time for us to give advice to clients to help them figure out what to do. But of course, it's an even more challenging time for clients trying to make a decision about what to do. Really, the best advice is that they should wait, this middle category. They should wait for the election to see who wins all three of those offices, which will then maybe give them some sense for what's going to happen with the exemption, whether it will fall or whether it will stay where it is. The problem with that is that if they wait and if the exemption does fall so that they need to take action, every single estate planning attorney who is capable of designing and implementing a structure that would allow that segment of the clientele to capture the exemption before it falls will be overwhelmed with other clients needing the exact same work. I can't emphasize this enough. And I just hearken back to the 2020 election. Remember the 2020 election when, let's say in June or July, the polling, which of course was wrong, but the polling at that time suggested that there was going to be a blue tsunami. And if the blue tsunami would have come to pass, it would have resulted in a material adverse change to the estate tax laws. So in recognition of that, I reached out to my clients who would have had taxable estates and ended up doing 3 years of work in 1.5 years. Think about that. Because I had so many clients who said, oh my goodness, we have to take action before this blue wave crashes all over us and destroys our estate plan and causes us to have to pay so much more in estate tax. I had 105 clients design and implement a brand new estate tax reduction strategy. And the best news is, even though the blue wave did not come to pass, and even though the estate tax laws did not change as a consequence of the 2020 election, none of those 105 clients were upset about having done this work. They all needed to have it done. They all considered it carefully. And they all made informed decisions. And they all believed that their decisions were really good decisions. And I feel great about that. However, that was an overwhelming amount of work, not just for me, but for everyone in my firm, and not just for my firm, but for every top firm was in the exact same boat. It would be a challenge. And we're expecting that it's going to be a challenge. So then the question is, if you're in an estate taxable situation, what could you do? Basically, there are two things that you could do, but there are a million varieties, or maybe better said, an infinite number of varieties for each of these two things. So there's nothing that's off the shelf. Here, let me just pull this and give it to you and you're done. Everything has to be customized to meet the individual client's specific, particular, and unique goals and objectives. So here are the two things that could be done. Clients can make gifts to children. But really, they wouldn't make gifts to children. Really, what they would do is they would create irrevocable gift trusts for the benefit of children and make gifts into those trusts, because by doing that, they can give their children the same three benefits that I described earlier when I was talking about a more sophisticated revocable trust. And those same three benefits are, first, divorce protection; second, creditor and liability protection; and third, estate tax protection through the use of generation skipping. Not skipping the kids, skipping the estate tax in the kids' own estates. So an irrevocable trust can accomplish that objective. There are other reasons for creating an irrevocable trust and other levers and methods for creating an irrevocable trust, including who pays the income tax. Those kinds of trusts can be designed so that mom and dad pay the income tax on behalf of the kids. And every time mom and dad do that, that's the equivalent of mom and dad making a gift to the kids in the amount of the income tax that was paid, but it's not treated as a gift. It doesn't have to be designed that way. But for extremely wealthy clients, it might make sense to design it that way, because every time mom and dad pay that tax, they're reducing their own estate and benefiting the kids. So one structure is to give it to the kids, or better yet, trust for the benefit of the kids. And there is an alternative for those clients who don't think they can afford to give those assets to the kids. Because first and foremost, whatever action clients take, they need to be comfortable with. And they need to have, maintain, and preserve their own personal economic security. So we're not going to give away all the assets. Like, if you had a $50 million estate, the easiest to make to pay no estate tax, you could write a check to your favorite charity, all $50 million, you're done. Except now you have nothing that you can live on. So that doesn't make sense. If you had a client who was worth $35 million, they could give $27 to the kids, but then they would only have $8 million left. And they've been living off of $35 million. They're not going to be happy living off of $8 million. They won't do that. So what's the alternative? there is an alternative. It's appropriate for a certain segment of clientele. It's called a spousal lifetime access trust. It's only applicable to married couples. And at 100,000 feet, here's how it works. Husband creates a spousal lifetime access trust, SLAT, for the benefit of wife, where wife is the beneficiary for her whole life. And when she dies, those assets go to the kids. And husband, who has created this trust for the benefit of wife, then gifts the exemption amount of assets into that trust. And similarly, wife could create a SLAT, a spousal lifetime access trust, for the benefit of husband, where husband is the beneficiary for his whole life. And when he's gone, the kids become the beneficiaries. And wife could then gift the exemption amount of assets into that trust. And if you do this, you can lodge $27 or $28 million of assets in these trusts, and the parents are still the beneficiaries. And as an example, every time wife takes a distribution from her trust, and she's still married, husband's standing right next to her, he's going to benefit indirectly from wife's distribution. And the reverse is true too. Anytime husband takes a distribution from his trust, and they're still married, and wife's standing right next to him, she benefits indirectly from husband's distribution. So this is a structure that allows a married couple to give away their exemption of assets and still retain the use of those assets. So for a segment of the clientele, it's a great structure. Now, it's somewhat inefficient because they're keeping cash flow. So they didn't need the cash flow. If they could afford for the children to have these assets, it'd be more efficient from a tax perspective for the children to get these assets, but not at the expense of creating uncertainty in the minds of the parents, creating uncomfortability. We want them to feel as if they have all of the economic security that they want. And so a SLAT could be a better alternative than gift trust for the benefit of the kids. So that's what clients are thinking about. And my role is to help them understand every detail, the pros and cons, the alternatives, put them in a position to make an informed decision that works for them, including, hey, I don't want to do that. It's too complicated. Or, I love that. Let's do it. I can't wait to save all that tax.
You know, there's definitely families that fall in the, I want to have something that's more complicated. I want to fill up the federal government and what I'm paying to them the least, and yeah, fill up the other buckets, and we'll do whatever it takes to make a, let's say, less complicated estate a little bit more advanced, like using strategies that you just mentioned. And then I think one of the points that you made, and I always like the analogy, it's like when you're in an airplane and something happens and the mask, the oxygen mask falls down, you always take care of yourself. If you're an adult and you have little children with you, as an adult, you take care of yourself first and then you put your children's on. And I think a lot of families, it's important to, as you mentioned, to think about that, where even if you do have a large estate, you might be using all of the money that's in your estate to live your life, which might be an expensive life, to where, you know, just because it's over the exemption amount today, it might not be in the future because you're spending that money down. Hopefully it's growing and you're planning for the future and for your children. But I think that's important because, you know, you need access to that money. And sometimes it's not always the right strategy to set up these complicated trusts because you may be living a lavish life and that's just something that doesn't work for your future.
Well, that's right. That's why every situation is different. You have to evaluate what the client's goals and objectives are, what their fears and concerns are, and match those to an appropriate solution that works for them.
Right.
And I do get clients who say to me, look, I realize I have a large estate, but I can't tolerate any complexity. So I don't want to do whatever you're going to recommend. And what I will do with those clients is show them what they could do, not force them to do anything, show them what they could do, and then pose this question. Is it worth tolerating this complexity in order to save X million dollars of tax? So sometimes the answer is, no, I still don't want that complexity. Sometimes the answer is, oh my goodness, I didn't realize I could save that much tax. I'm willing to endure that complexity, especially because I have a great team of advisors, including my accountant, including my financial advisor, who are going to help me to manage this structure. It's worth it. And a lot of clients reach that decision. It is worth it to save millions of dollars of tax.
Absolutely. The amount saving, it's hard to plan for so long in the future, but accidents happen and you're not always planning for what's going to happen with your health and things in the future. So being ahead of that is important. And I think one more item that wasn't mentioned, but I think it's worth mentioning on structures and things to do to lower estates. You mentioned setting up trusts for children and using your exemptions. And I think it's important to mention that there's also non-structures, right, to get money outside of your estate, like paying directly to your kids' schools for education for health and things of that nature, which don't count as part of your annual exclusion.
Well, that's a great point. So in addition to the estate tax exemption, parents can do three things that don't count against that exemption. First is parents can make annual exclusion gifts to kids. So what that means is each parent can give $18,000 to anybody in the world except me. So two parents together can give $36,000 to each kid. If they have three kids, that's $100,000. If they had grandkids, multiply that by the number of grandkids. Giving away the annual exclusion can be an extremely powerful thing over the course of time. The second is parents can pay for educational expenses directly to the educational provider, and it doesn't count as a gift. In fact, parents can make a deal with the educational institution to prepay tuition. Like, for example, if there's a child who's matriculating at UCLA and is going to be there for 4 years, I don't know what the tuition is at UCLA, maybe it's $80,000. Parents could approach the administration at UCLA to write a check for 4 years worth of tuition, and all 4 years are out of the estate. Or grandparents could do that. And then, as you mentioned, medical expenses directly paid to the healthcare provider, and including medical insurance. Parents or grandparents can pay for those things, and those do not count as gifts. It's potentially very powerful and very helpful, especially to a younger generation who might not yet have significant cash.
On behalf of our team and people who are going to listen to this, I think there's a lot of things out there. And if anyone has any questions, I know they'll be able to reach out to either us or get in contact with you. And just want to thank you for your time and expertise on this subject matters.
Really my pleasure. Appreciate the invitation.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.